I want to go on to our interview with Sonia Pressman Fuentes. She was born in 1928, and her family came to this country in 1934 to escape the Holocaust. As a child, her family traveled throughout Florida, and she saw firsthand Jim Crow and was very, very horrified by it. She went on to become a founder of the National Organization for Women, and she was the first woman attorney in the office of the General Counsel at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. We're now going to hear her side of the story, where she was at during all these events. She was right in the thick of things, and you're going to want to hear what happened after women finally did get into, at least on paper, the 1964 Civil Rights Act. I have on the phone with me Sonia Pressman Fuentes, who was on the scene during the events we are discussing tonight. Sonia Pressman Fuentes, it is such an honor to have you here.
Hello, and I'm delighted to be on your show.
Let us set the scene about what we're going to talk about. It's 1965. The Civil Rights Act is now law, and a new agency has been created to enforce Title VII, which is the part of the Civil Rights Act that deals with employment. It is called the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or EEOC. And you, Sonia Pressman Fuentes, are the first woman lawyer hired by the Office of the General Counsel of the EEOC.
We were there to answer and deal with legal questions that came up with regard to interpretation of the statute. The statute was, like all statutes, fairly bare bone. It had a legislative history, and when legal issues came up, it was the job of the General Counsel's office to provide advice on how those issues should be interpreted in the light of particular complaints that were filed.
So as you were dealing with the legal issues raised by the complaints that were coming in to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, did you notice any difference between the way the different kinds of complaints were being dealt with?
Yes, definitely. And this caused me an increasing amount of frustration. What I noticed was, and it was obvious to anybody who would be looking at it, that the EOC commissioners were, by and large, not dealing with issues of, in those days we called it sex discrimination, today we call it gender discrimination, but the statute talks about sex discrimination. And the EOC was not really coming to grips with the issues raised by the complaints. And there were two reasons for that. One was, most of the people who were at the commission, and at that time the commission had 100 permanent employees, most of them were there to fight charges of race discrimination based on race or color. The act was passed as a result of the civil rights movement, and most of the people there were there to do something about civil rights in employment. The prohibition against sex discrimination only came in the latter stages of the debate, and the country was not ready for it because it hadn't been preceded by a movement for women's rights, as it had been preceded by a movement for rights for blacks. So one thing was they didn't particularly care to deal with issues of sex discrimination. That isn't why they were there. And the other reason is that the issues of sex discrimination raised more difficult legal matters, legal questions of interpretation that no one knew how to answer because it hadn't been preceded by a women's movement.
So what percentage of complaints were coming in from women who had been discriminated against?
Well, at the end of the first fiscal year, everybody was surprised to learn that 37% of the complaints filed with the commission alleged sex discrimination. And this was a revelation to everyone because, as I mentioned, and you mentioned, the prohibition against sex discrimination in employment only came in the latter stages of the debate on the act, and it was a total surprise.
My understanding is that because this large percentage of complaints that were coming in from women were not being given their due by the EEOC, that almost a kind of underground network of women in government had formed, and that you were part of that, who were trying to get the EEOC to pay attention to this part of its mandate. Can you talk about that?
Yes, and it wasn't just women. There was also a man involved in this underground network, and his name was Phineas Indrich.
Okay.
We were individuals, I would say, mostly lawyers, who worked in various agencies of the federal government at mid-level positions. And this group included me, Phineas Indrich, Mary Eastwood, Carruthers Berger, Catherine East, and others who somehow got to know each other. I can't remember how. And we would share information on women's rights that each of us knew, and I was probably in the key position because I was the only one of this group at the EOC. So we would discuss what was going on at the EOC with regard to sex discrimination, and we all were frustrated about what was not being done in regard to charges of sex discrimination.
And then one day, Betty Friedan showed up at the EEOC. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. One day, Betty Friedan showed up. As you know, in 1963, she had published the seminal book, The Feminine Mystique. And when she came to the offices of the General Counsel, because she thought she was going to write a second book about all the progress women had achieved since the publication of her book in 1963, and she came there to interview my boss, the general counsel, and his deputy. But she saw me there, a woman, so she came over to me and she said, "What's going on here? What are the problems? What are the conflicts?" And I felt that if I told her what was going on, I would lose my job. So I said to her, "Nothing, everything is just fine here." So I don't remember what else she did that day, but she came back again about 2 weeks later, and she asked me again what was going on. And she happened to come at a day when I had it up to here, up to my neck. And I invited her into the privacy of my office, and I told her that the EOC was not really interpreting and enforcing the sex discrimination prohibitions of the act. And I had tears rolling down my cheek when I told her that. And I told her that what this country needed was an organization like the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, to fight for women like the NAACP fought for, and in those days I would have used, Negroes.
And Betty Friedan, of course, was there as a writer, as an author. She had no intention at that time of becoming the activist who had become one of the most well-known founder of the National Organization for Women. But this was something that was to happen in pretty quick succession to these events. Can you tell us how that whole process began, where the fight to get the EEOC to enforce its mandate to tackle complaints that were coming in from women turned into an action wing, one of the first action wings of what was to become a whole new feminist movement? Tell us about that transition.
What happened was that in June of 1966, there was a national conference of the commissions on the status of women being held in Washington, D.C. And that conference was held under the aegis of the Labor Department. So at that conference, the women wanted to pass some resolutions. They wanted to pass a resolution that the EOC should begin to implement more effectively the sex discrimination prohibitions of Title VII, and should also reappoint Commissioner Dick Graham, because the women feared that Dick Graham, who was a feminist, would not be reappointed. The women were told that they did not have the authority to pass resolutions, and they became incensed about that. So that night they met in Betty Friedan's hotel room at the hotel where the conference was going on, and the next day at lunch, Betty Friedan wrote on a paper napkin that we are creating now to bring women into the mainstream of American society now. And 28 women signed that paper napkin and each threw a dollar into the kitty. And that was the first meeting at which NOW was formed. And that was in June of 66.
And that's the National Organization for Women.
Correct.
And what did NOW take on at that point, particularly in relation to the EEOC? And what role did you play in all of that?
Well, NOW immediately began to become an activist organization. It picketed the EEOC and the White House. It filed complaints of discrimination, which organizations could file on behalf of somebody else. And it got publicity, and it began to put pressure on the EEOC to take action with regard to women's rights.
Sonia, tell me about some of the activities of the National Organization for Women in relation to the EEOC and what role you played and other women played in, shall I say, getting information to the activists.
Well, one of the things that I did was that when I saw cases coming down the pike at the EEOC that raised issues of sex discrimination, I would share that information with this cadre, with this underground network that I mentioned to you that had formed. And then this underground group would tell Marguerite Raywalt, who was a trailblazing lawyer in Washington, D.C., a feminist whom we all knew. And Marguerite developed a cadre of feminist lawyers around the country who were ready to represent plaintiffs in sex discrimination cases. And another thing that I did was that I used to meet in the apartment of Mary Eastwood in Washington with Mary, with Carruthers Berger, with Phineas Indritz, and I would share with them things that had happened at the EEOC that day or that week where I felt they weren't doing what they should on women's rights issues. And then we would draft a letter to the EEOC from NOW saying, how come you're not doing this? How come you're not doing that? Why did you do this? And we would send those letters to the EEOC.
Mm-hmm.
And to my surprise, nobody ever raised the question of how come NOW knows what the EEOC is doing.
So you were kind of an insider who was giving information to the outside.
Right, and I knew that was improper. I knew it then and I know it now, but my zeal for women's rights and my frustration with the EEOC's failure to act led me to do that.
Okay. We have told the history many times of the early days of NOW and how it went on to become a national organization, really the first large organization of what would become the second wave, which had many branches, which we've also spoken about on this show. Can you give me some kind of overview of where you think this has taken us, how you feel about it, where you think we still have to go?
Okay, well, let's take one of those at a time. Let's start with your question of what has been accomplished as a result of federal laws like the Equal Pay Act and Title VII and state laws and municipal regulations and pressure by the EEOC. And I always say that we've had nothing less than a legal revolution in the rights of women in this country. Our society has undergone massive change. Women are now found in large numbers in professional schools and in the professions, and to a much lesser extent in executive suites and legislatures. Women now work at a host of technical and blue-collar jobs previously closed to them. In 1976, women were admitted to West Point and our other military academies, a development that was unthinkable before the women's movement. And the percent of women in the military has risen from less than 2% in the 1960s to about 20% today, and the variety of their assignments has increased. The effects of Title VII have spilled over. After all, Title VII deals only with employment, but it has spilled over to every area of our society. Laws have changed women's rights with regard to abortion, divorce, alimony, child custody, child support, rape, jury service, appointments as administrators and executors of estates. In the past, women couldn't be named administrators and executors of estates. Sentencing for crimes. Before the women's movement, in some states, I know Pennsylvania was one, a woman could be given a longer sentence for the same crime than a man would be given. And the reason for that was that there was this theory that women were better creatures than men, finer people. So if a woman committed a crime, she must be really bad, and therefore she was entitled to a longer sentence. That has changed. Well, other things that have changed are admission to places of public accommodation, such as clubs, restaurants, and bars. Our spoken language has changed, and we've done a lot of work on the development of gender-neutral written language in laws, textbooks, religious texts, and all kinds of publications. Women are now being included in clinical research studies, and this was discussed only recently, although it's been going on for a while, but it's been discussed also recently. We are learning that men and women react differently to different medications, and when research scientists do studies only on male rats and not female rats, they are developing results that are may not be applicable to women.
So you've given us quite a list, and of course we both know that we could go on and on because the changes have been so vast. Is there anything you'd like to say that kind of sums it up?
Well, the changes that have occurred since 1965 are way beyond anything that the founders of NOW, including me, ever envisioned at the time we got started. We had no idea that we were creating such a revolution in women's rights, and therefore if you change women's rights, you change men's roles. We had no idea we were creating such a resolution. We were primarily interested in getting the EOC to enforce its job, to getting women hired and promoted, and get women into academia and into graduate programs, but we did not realize at the beginning how this would spill over into every aspect of American life. And I am very grateful to have lived long enough to have seen this tremendous change in our society.
And you were an important part of it on the ground floor of the second wave, I must say.
Thank you.
Sonia Pressman Fuentes, it has been a real pleasure to have you come to the airways of Joy of Resistance.